Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a pretty good start so far this morning. 10:06 is the time right now. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. We'll look at some of the latest news from the world of science this hour, because it's time for another edition of Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. Then after the news at 11, we'll go to the phones for our first open hour of the week. We call it Manic Monday, and of course, as always, anything goes next hour. After the news at noon, we'll discuss the life and times of Nova Scotia's 23rd Premier. Author Lindsay Ruck will join me to talk about her new book. It's called Against the Grain, a biography of Dr. John Savage. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon with historian and author Blair Bead. But this hour, it is time for Science Files. And joining me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist, Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. I haven't even got my tweet out. You're so quick this morning.
Well, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
You're still recovering from all those squats you did this morning.
Yeah, no. It's Monday, Wednesday, Friday workouts, my wife and I. And today was a squat day. Wednesday will be deadlifts.
You're a better man than I. Yeah, that's
all
I can say.
I won't comment on that. But anyway.
902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255 if you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning. Again, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also reach us via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a comment or a question. Our Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. The Spitzer Space Telescope been shut down. In fact, January 30th, the telescope was put into safe mode. Yep. And ceased operation. I didn't know that there was this other telescope. They're calling it the twin, basically, or the brother of the Hubble telescope.
Well, so I think in a way it kind of is. So this was a huge, huge thing when it launched. So it was supposed to go up around 2001, 2002, but there were delays. And at that time, I was actually in California. I was actually working as a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. And everyone was super excited about Spitzer because it was going to show the universe at a wavelength, well, with higher resolution than we'd ever used in the infrared wavelengths. And so that got people really, really excited. And then eventually it was launched. We got to see, like, really, really far off things. We got to see things that we weren't anticipating, like an even bigger ring of debris around Saturn that we didn't think was going to be there. Hmm. But finding, like, clusters of galaxies that were very, very young in the very, very distant universe as well. And just looking at stellar nurseries where stars were being born. The amazing thing about Spitzer is it not only allows you to see certain types of gas and dust, it also allows you to see through other types of gas and dust as well. So it was really like pulling a curtain off the universe.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I'm reading here that it had an ability to see objects in the universe essentially by temperature instead of visible
light.
That's right.
That's right. Yep. So you're going to longer wavelengths than visible light. And once you start doing that, you're literally starting to measure the temperature of the thing you're looking at based upon the infrared radiation that you receive.
Oh, okay. And the Spitzer telescope was named after astronomer Lyman Spitzer Jr., who was the first to suggest placing telescopes in space to get a clearer view of the universe. Yep. That seemed to me like a no-brainer then.
Yeah, well, I know, but I mean, so I think he suggested it in the late 1940s or something that. Yeah. So he was like really ahead of the game, as it were. And it took, the Americans were thinking about this during the sort of like the peak of the space race in the 60s, but there were a lot of things that they wanted to get done first, and then Hubble eventually sort of like got pushed off, and eventually launched in the 80s.
Yeah, and it says here that during its extended period of life of more than a decade, Spitzer was able to study the atmospheres of exoplanets and basically give us weather reports on alien worlds.
Yeah, no, I forgot. That was one of the really cool things it did as well. So it was they used Spitzer to take the first ever temperature map of a planet around another star.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing. How do they do these things?
So that one is actually a little bit fun because they knew that the particular planet that was going around the star was what we call tidally locked. It always had one face pointing towards the star. So as it went round the star, you got to see different parts of it.
Okay.
And because of that, you could put a temperature map on it. And so that's what they did with it. It was a very crude temperature map. All you really sort of like see is like basically how it changes as you rotate the planet. But it's cool. It was fun.
Yeah, it says one of its targets as well, the TRAPPIST-1 system, where seven Earth-sized planets, three of them in the habitable zone, where liquid water could exist on their surfaces, but wasn't able to prove any of that, right?
Oh, well, so, I mean, we know the structure of TRAPPIST-1 primarily because of a lot of the timing that we get from the different orbits around there. So, and the as you get the star blocked out, you can figure out what the periods are and so on. So that's how we figured out TRAPPIST-1.
Yeah. And it says here the headline, one big eye in the sky closes, but a bigger one is on the way. And is this the Webb telescope?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're not quite the same, but a good enough way of thinking about it. So Webb is kind of like... People call it a super Hubble. It's not really a super Hubble. It looks in longer wavelengths, just outside the visible and maybe a little bit further. So it will look really at the very far away universe.
Okay.
So it's looking for radiation that's come from so far away, it's been what we call redshifted. So JWST will be really good at that. But it also look at things in our own solar system as well, things very far out in the outer parts of the solar system as well. It's going to be good for that too.
So, I mean, would they be able to actually focus in on one of these exoplanets and actually see the physical shape or contours or anything along those lines?
No. That is not going to happen for a long time, because to be able to do that, you need a telescope that is what we call an optical interferometer. And so that is effectively a telescope that is incredibly wide, literally like 30 to 100 kilometers wide. And so the technology we need to do that effectively isn't developed yet. And NASA and the European Space Agency, they were working on two designs to do this, but the harsh reality is it's so expensive to do that it was basically sort of like shunted off to the side. And so that could come, I'll be optimistic. Like I wrote an article about this in a magazine that got a lot of recommendations, but I said 2060. Right, for something like that. And I still think that's probably reasonable, but there are a lot of technical issues to sort out. You've got to basically have spacecraft flying in formation together, aligned at fractions of the width of an atom. That's not an easy thing to do.
Okay. Right. But the Webb telescope, I'm already here, is long delayed and seriously over budget right now.
Well, it's certainly long delayed. Depending upon which budget you believe, how seriously over budget it is. I mean, it's been capped at around $8 billion for a while, and it's there. I think the thing that is bad with Webb was they said, okay, we want to reduce the cost. So they reduced the size, but they hardly reduced the cost by doing that. There were still all these other engineering challenges to solve. So that descoping, as we call it, descope a telescope, that's made the telescope smaller and probably not saved a whole lot of money. And so there was a review of that and said, yeah, you know, that probably wasn't a great idea.
Yeah. How much life does Hubble have left in it?
Probably not that much longer. It will keep going for a little bit, but the gyroscopes are starting to go. And once the gyroscopes start going, you can't really point it anymore. So that's going to be the limiting thing with Hubble. So I think it can run in with two operating gyroscopes, but always better to have three or more.
All right. It is coming up to 10:14. He is Dr. Rob Thacker, and this is Science Files on a Monday morning. And if you've got a comment or a question, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. A couple of calls just coming in now. We've also got an email we'll pass on as well. Our email address, rick.howe@news957.com, or a Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. We're back with more of Dr. Rob and Science Files right after this quick break. Coming up now to 10:17, Science Files on a Monday morning with Dr. Rob Thacker, and Brian's on the line with a question this morning. Hi, Brian.
Good morning, Rick, Dr. Rob.
Hi,
thanks,
Brian,
for taking my call. I was listening to your show the other week, and there was one of the people called in and asked about how far could you fall on the moon without hurting yourself or something along those lines. And I was wondering, where there's no atmosphere on the moon, wouldn't your speed just increase? Wouldn't that have an effect?
Okay, that's a very good question. And so the short answer is, for a human body falling, like, I think most people say like 20 or 30 feet is as far as you want to go before you're really sort of like risking your life, as it were. And so at those speeds, the air resistance that you feel is slowing you down a little bit, but not that much. Okay, so it's not, I can't give you an exact number, but you haven't reached what's called your terminal velocity. And so when we go and look at the moon, we've got about basically one-fifth of the gravity. So logically, you could probably go about five times higher. So that's over 100 feet, as we were saying. And you're right. I mean, you won't feel the air resistance as you come down. In fact, there's a famous example of a movie from the moon where they drop a feather and a hammer and they both fall at the same rate.
That's right, yeah.
Right? So that is true. But it basically, air resistance just doesn't have enough of an impact in our own atmosphere for something like a human. If you take a feather, then yeah, absolutely it has a big impact, but for something like us, no, it doesn't have too big an impact.
There you go, Brian.
One more thing real quick.
Sure.
So this terminal velocity, is that the atmosphere that says that, or the amount of gravity that says that?
Both. It's a sort of balance between the two of them, right? The resistance that you get from having a certain cross-section and a certain density of the atmosphere balanced against gravity trying to accelerate you.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, cool.
Appreciate
the call.
All right, thanks, Brian. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. And Frank emails to wonder, how far does the Earth travel in one orbit of the sun? And does the speed or path of that orbit ever vary, or are they constant?
Well, okay, so on the spot. So the radius, as I remember, is about 150 million kilometers for the Earth's orbit. And so if you approximate it as a circle, then you're looking at 2 pi r, so 6 times 150 million. So about, close to a billion kilometers, I guess. So it's a long way to travel, however you look at it. Does it change its speed? The answer is yes, it does. So what's constant in the Earth's travel in its orbit around the sun is what we call the angular momentum. And because the Earth gets slightly further away and slightly closer, it's got a slightly elliptical orbit, then its actual speed as it goes around does change just a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. And I think it's our friend Bob on the line here this morning. Hi, Bob.
And that it is, gentlemen.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great.
Good. So what question do you have for us today?
It's going to be an interesting one.
Quick questions, but I think they all fall into one place.
Okay.
All righty.
We know, and Dr.
Thacker.
Yes.
Rob.
I just lost my thought for a second. Sorry.
That's all right. I lost my train of thought last week for the first time. That's okay, Bob.
Well, one thing, you don't blow my bubbles, you just expand them. Believe me, your show does an excellent job on that. What I want to know is, we know that life is throughout the universe in different aspects, and if they find the right planet to land on, but before they get to the right planet to land on to make life, it's going through horrible gases and heats and radiation and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So I was watching a program on the Galapagos Islands and about volcanoes.
Yeah.
Is it possible that life can come out of the volcano, the lava itself? Can it carry life of some sort? And that's, I guess, that's my question, guy.
All right. Okay. Well, appreciate it, Bob. Thank you very much.
Okay. I mean, so many things to comment on. So first of all, talking about life in the universe in general, like, I mean, we only think there's other life out there. We don't know for sure yet.
Yeah.
I mean, the evidence that we have on the basis of how quickly things evolved on the Earth, well, then we think, yeah, there is probably life out there. And so then the question seems to be like, how do we get life when basically like planets are forming with really high temperatures, magma and volcanoes and so on? And so the answer is, a lot of the material that gets deposited to actually start the process of forming life, we've been able to detect that in space itself. So the amino acids get deposited in meteorites coming down. That's a known thing. And so can anything survive in a hot magma or anything like that? Certainly nothing that we are aware of. I mean, those temperatures are so high that I'm sure that they basically cook DNA and break it apart in whatever way possible. Where there is a really interesting question about that is in relation to what are called black smokers. These are very, very deep hydrothermal vents in the ocean.
In the ocean, yeah.
Yeah, and so we do see life around those, but we think that's life that's literally evolved in one way or another to live in that kind of environment. So in terms of volcanoes, hot magma and so on, I really don't know how anything can survive that kind of temperature, but it doesn't matter because you can get other stuff being deposited down on the Earth that would get that process of forming life going, I guess.
But outside of the lava issue, there would be life that would be living in and around volcano tops and in the gases that perhaps
I mean, life can evolve towards surviving in higher and higher temperatures. I mean, we have life that will survive in the saltiest temperatures, in boiling waters and things like that. But boiling water still isn't as hot as magma is, obviously.
Ron just emailed us a question. He says, considering the lack of heavy elements, were galaxies in the very early universe much different than galaxies today? And he adds, I assume there were no dust lanes or spirals.
That's a fantastic question.
Good. Well,
right? I mean, that is a research level question.
Oh, really?
Okay. So people actively look at this. So the short answer is we are very interested to see what the first generation of galaxies looked like. And that is one of the key goals for the James Webb Space Telescope. And so, yes, absolutely, we would have a tendency to think that until there has been lots of what we call interstellar recycling, so lots of generations of stars formed, you won't see as much dust in those particular galaxies. But, and there is a big but to all of that, you form very big and massive stars very quickly, right? And those very big and very massive stars form very quickly, and they also burn out very quickly.
Okay.
Right? And so if they burn out very quickly and go off in a supernova, they may actually deposit a whole whack of dust really, really quickly. And so the short answer is, we're not sure, right?
Okay.
So we want to go and have a look and see what this tells us about whether there is some kind of difference in the first generation of stars that form versus the overall pattern that we think is typical of stars forming in general in the universe.
But we also know that galaxies are expanding, constantly expanding, are they not?
Well, the space between galaxies is constantly expanding.
Oh.
Galaxies themselves are not expanding.
Okay.
Galaxies themselves are getting bigger, but that's because they're sort of like accreting more things and merging with other galaxies.
Okay.
Okay. So that is a great question, and it's one of the things that we really want to look at with the with the James Webb Space Telescope.
Well, speaking of close-up shots, the new photos of the sun, the most detailed images ever taken of the sun. This is from a powerful new telescope that sits on top of a volcano in Hawaii. It's the Daniel Inouye Solar Telescope, which sits at around 3,000 meters above sea level near the summit of this, I'm not even going to try to pronounce the volcano.
Haleakala.
Okay, good for you. In Maui, Hawaii.
Yeah.
And again, some remarkable images of the sun. I mean, I'm floored at what I see here today.
I mean, I should tweet a picture of this because this is absolutely
truly
spectacular,
is. Yeah.
Right? And so we're now able to sort of resolve the surface of the sun with higher precision than we've been able to do from the Earth. And this telescope is absolutely amazing, right? It's got a 4-meter mirror, right? And you take a magnifying glass in your hand and you focus sunlight, what happens?
Yeah.
You burn things
super
quickly. Now imagine having a magnifying glass 4 meters across.
Yep.
So you've got to think that this thing is dangerous. How on earth does it work? And so the short answer is, and this is going to blow your mind, you collect the light from this 4-meter mirror and then you focus it down onto another mirror that's basically about a foot in diameter. So you've concentrated all of that light. But in between those two mirrors, there's something called the heat stop. It's literally a filter that has to be cooled with the equivalent of 4 fire hoses to get rid of all of the heat.
Ooh.
Right? And so this is incredible. Like, it's literally, if that thing breaks, big trouble.
Yeah,
right?
Seriously.
Right? So they've got this, literally this filter that's constantly being actively cooled. Right, and taking away the amount of energy, they said it's literally megawatts per meter squared. Right now, it's not a meter squared, so you're looking at perhaps a tens, maybe 100 kilowatts or something like that. But there's a lot of energy being taken out of this thing just to allow them to be able to pass the light through, the very dimmed light through, to all of the instruments that are going to be used to take these images and take spectra of what's going on with all of the atoms in the atmosphere around the sun as well. So this is an incredible piece of technology, right? Just mind-blowing.
Yeah, reading here that says studying the sun's activity or the space weather, it says here, can help scientists predict problems on Earth. Magnetic eruptions on the sun can disrupt satellites, disable GPS, impact air travel, those kinds of things. And according to the director of the telescope, this telescope, he says, will improve our understanding of what drives space weather and ultimately help forecasters better predict solar storms.
So here's the key thing, right? And I wish I could show everyone the image, because the image is just spectacular.
It is.
So you're literally seeing cells that are the size of Texas, right?
Yeah.
And the dark things are basically magnetic flux tubes. And so that is a key part of understanding how the energy gets from this surface of the sun, the photosphere of the sun, up into the atmosphere of the sun that we call the corona.
Yep.
And so this process is incredibly complex. It uses basically magnetic fields to do that. And we've got to get more and more information about this particular area by taking these beautiful images, but also, as I said, taking spectra to see what's going on, looking at basically how the light is polarized as well. That will tell us about this intervening chromosphere up to the corona in the atmosphere of the sun. And really, this is going to open a whole bunch of new doors on solar research. We're going to be able to understand a lot more of these processes. And this is really, really hard physics to do, right? And so the more information we can get, the more we're going to understand what's going on. I mean, as amazing as the sun is, it's an incredibly complicated thing.
Well, I'm sure if you could somehow, you know, post those pictures online so that people can see it. If you haven't seen those, I mean, they're absolutely spectacular. And our resident comedian, Daryl, just emailed, "Why didn't the sun go to college? Because it already had a million degrees," he writes. 1029. Yeah, something like that. 1029. It's a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker and Science Files here till 11. We're going to take a quick break right now, though. We've got a news update coming up for you. Then we're back with more. We're back right after the news, and it is coming up next. It is 10:35 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker is my guest for another edition of Science Files. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll go to Rick in a moment. But let me ask you, Dr. Rob, first about the satellites and a potential collision course. There was an alert last week suggesting that the two would, these two, apparently they're not, they're inoperable now, but they're still out there, would pass within 15 to 30 meters of each other, putting them at a 1 in 100 risk of a collision that says here could potentially create hundreds of pieces of space debris, threatening satellites in a similar orbit. But they passed each other and no incident. But how close are we to actually seeing this happened, satellites up there orbiting the Earth and perhaps colliding with one another?
Yeah. So, I mean, collisions have happened, right? So that is a fact, and there are debris fields that we actively follow as a result of those collisions. But in this particular case, it was a near miss, as they say, right? So, but the bigger concern in all of this is once you create a debris field, it just spreads out over time. And once those things get going and spreading out, then they can have a really significant danger for other satellites, right? And so one of the concerns with this is, as we've talked about this before, right, is something called Kessler syndrome, which is essentially what we call a collisional cascade. Then when once you have one collision, it creates so many bits and pieces that fly off in different directions that they go off and hit other things and then break those things up and create this huge basically swath of debris that basically wipes everything out. Anyone who's seen Gravity has seen kind of like the idea behind that. And so this is a real concern. And in fact, the Canadian Astronomical Society, of which I'm currently the president, we're about to release a press statement about our concern about this and people putting lots and lots of satellites up there. People probably don't know, but the European Space Agency already had to move one of their satellites because of basically one of Starlink's launches. And so,
and there's going to be how many with this Starlink?
Oh, there's going to be, they're saying 12,000 is what they'd like to aim for, but they've put up as suggested they could go as high as 40,000. And to a certain extent, the problems with Starlink aren't too bad in as much that they're going to be low enough that a lot of them will deorbit. But nonetheless, there's going to be a race to see who can get things up there before people start putting limits on it. Right. So Musk is ahead of the game. He's like, I'm going to put as many things up there as soon as I can before there's any kind of regulation on this. And then he'll be up there and he'll basically have the market. So it's all market economics, basically. And my concern with all of this is, what happens when you have something that's a common resource and everyone's fighting over, right? Basically, everyone tries to get their slice of the pie until things go horribly wrong. And in this case, things going horribly wrong are a collision that basically leads to some orbital windows. Basically, you can't use them anymore.
And is it just a matter of time before it happens, really?
Well, I mean, the mathematics team seems to suggest so. I mean, there may be the possibilities. There are many, right? But one of the things that could happen is Musk gets all of his up there and gets the whole market and everyone else goes, oh, well, what's the point, right? Probably not going to happen. Right. Hmm. But at the end of the day, if you're competing with other people and you're trying to make money off of this and there's a risk, you just continue accepting that risk until it becomes unacceptable, which is all about money. Right. And so something has to be done. And so we're releasing a statement on this, hopefully this week. I've drafted it. I just need final approval to release it. Just saying, look, we've got to work together because this is a common resource for all of us. Near Earth orbit is a common resource. And we need to understand that it's something that we can't over-exploit, right? It needs to be managed. We don't even have really effective collision detection systems. Things are done right now by the military because they don't want other people to know where their spy's at.
Yeah.
Right? So they keep track of everything. They send notifications. And at the moment, it works by email. That's got to change. Now, there are plans to change that. The European Space Agency has suggested they could have an automated system in by 2030. But we're still going to need the cooperation of the military.
So who's your release? Who's it aimed at?
It's just going to be aimed at the press, basically.
Okay.
We had a number of different astronomical societies. I mean, we have concerns about the fact that you put all of these things up in orbit as well. It's going to make astronomy really difficult, too, because you just get satellite tracks everywhere. We talked about this before, right? That's a concern for us as well. But more than anything, we're concerned about the whole situation in orbit, right? It's not just about us wanting to carry on and do astronomy. It's about making sure this is effectively managed. Because literally the Outer Space Treaty, which was signed on by many, many nations, basically says, hey, it's out there. Peaceful. Let's all use it peacefully and we're good to go. And that's just not going to work if we get tens of thousands of satellites up there.
So who's going to be the determining factor in this? The U.S. government, NASA? I mean,
that
everyone,
is a very
the
good
world?
Question. And at the moment, we don't have anything that coordinates across the world. At the moment, it is a global resource.
Yeah.
Right? And so we need to just think about this carefully. The first step is to have better collision detection systems, collision avoidance systems. And there are sort of people, I won't say people aren't thinking about this, people are thinking about it, but even just simple little things like making sure these satellites aren't too reflective and on reasonable orbits. Like, I can't believe that Musk put one set on an orbit that made the European Space Agency move a satellite. Right? I mean, that's kind of mind-boggling to me. Anyway, so there we go. That's kind of, someone said it's kind of like we're right at the wild, wild west, right, for Earth orbit right now.
So it's going to have to come from the United Nations, I would assume, to get this kind of ball rolling.
It's certainly going to have to be an international organization of one sort or another. And it's not about trying to stop people do business or anything like that. It's not about that. It's just making sure that everything is regulated and everything is done so that this resource can be used to the best advantage for everyone, be it economic, be it social, be it scientific.
Let's go back to the phones. And Rick has a question for us this morning. Hey, Rick.
Hey. Look, funny how words trigger memories. He said near miss. I remember it was in a defensive driving course, and the instructor asked about who put up their hands, whoever had a near miss. And this one guy stood up and said he almost had a near miss. And the instructor said, what the hell are you talking about? And he said, well, it was an accident. And I don't think he was paying attention.
Anyway,
that's not a joke. That actually happened. But look, I'm calling about pH. In science, and not in, you know, the world out here, but just in science, when something is alkaline and it becomes less alkaline, is it proper to call it more acidic?
Okay. Dr. Rob?
If your pH is coming down, then yes, you would say it's more acidic, right? I mean, I think that's a reasonable way to talk about it. I mean, if you're up in the... Well, you could do it as terms of more basic or less basic, I suppose, if you wanted to do it that way.
Yeah, it could work both ways.
Yeah. I mean, that's okay. I mean, a chemist might give me a hard time about that, but I would know what you meant if the pH was coming down, sure.
Okay, good enough. That's it.
Thanks. All right, thanks, Rick. Let's go next to James this morning. Well, hello, James.
He's in orbit.
Yeah, I guess.
How's it going?
Good, sir. How are you today?
Not bad. Sorry about the background noise.
That's all right. Okay. You have a question for Dr. Rob.
Yeah, I just had a question about, I've not heard of it more recent, but I just wanted to know more about sinkholes and if they've come up at, you know, any other methods to detect them, and if not, what are we looking at for the future for maybe, you know, more things that were happening here in Nova Scotia. What was there, one in Oxford, I think it was?
Yep,
that's right.
Yep.
Yeah, well...
Okay.
I appreciate the... Thanks, James. Appreciate that. And, of course, the other aspect in the Oxford area is that the discovery of a sinkhole underneath the Highway 104,
yeah.
Trans-Canada.
So this is essentially... Sinkholes, by and large, are caused by chemical processes. Literally, it's water dissolving away certain types of rocks, leaving a hole. The hole collapses. You get a sinkhole, right? And so that is well understood. I mean, I'm not a geologist, but my understanding is if you want to know the type of rocks that you have in a given area, you've got to go and survey.
Yeah.
Right? That's all there is to it. So I don't know much more about it than that, to be honest. But surveying is how you know how at risk you are.
Well, I know that the federal and provincial governments are quite alarmed at the possibility of the sinkhole underneath the 104 right now.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out what to do about that.
But. I mean, so there are some sinkholes. There's one in South America that was formed really incredibly deeply, and that was a huge collapse.
Really? Right? Florida has problems with sinkholes as well, if I'm not mistaken.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, there's a lot of water moving around in Florida, obviously.
902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Mark emails to say, you mentioned the amount of energy being gathered by this new telescope from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way we can harness this energy, he wonders?
That's a sensible question, but the reality is if you look at the actual amount of energy that you're harnessing, it's not really that much more than basically a few tens of solar panels would actually get, right? So you can build solar panel arrays, actually have a larger collecting area. Right.
So, okay. Yeah. Daryl, with the question, we have sent small animals to space in the past. Would a bigger animal be able to survive a space trip like a cow, he wonders? That sounded to me when I first read that like a silly question. But if you're going to at some point down the road, you know, colonize the planet Mars, for example, would you not think about perhaps sending
livestock?
I don't know. I'm just throwing that out.
I don't know. And that is a very interesting question. I would tend to think you've got a whole issue of how you feed the cows.
Yeah.
Right. And as we all know, the concentration of plant material into meat is a energetic thing. It uses a lot of energy. And so it's probably not the best way we can think of to actually create something akin to meat. But I don't honestly know. I've not heard anyone talking about that. I wouldn't think it's a particularly practical thing to do, to be
honest. They don't have the capability as far as we know right now, right?
I've never seen anyone talking about it. I mean, it's an interesting question. But whenever people talk about taking food to Mars for exploration purposes, then you're talking about dried stuff and so on.
Yeah. 10:46. Paul, stay there. You're coming up next. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're back with more Science Files right after this quick break. 10:49, and David tweets, there's that output problem with livestock in space.
Oh, can I say it?
Yeah, go ahead, say it.
No shit.
Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Yes, hi. Dr. Rob is here. You have a question.
Yes. So I'm reading this morning in the Science News that the containers the U.S. plans to use for nuclear waste storage may corrode. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know Dr. Rob's thoughts and opinions on that topic.
All right. And that is the ongoing problem with nuclear power right now, is what to do with the nuclear waste.
Yeah. So this is a thing. I mean, it depends upon the corrosion on what time scale you're talking about. That's a big thing. And one of the harder things to work out, actually. So but in the big scheme of things, if you're looking at storing waste for tens of thousands of years, then yes, those particular storage containers will corrode. That's when you go to what's called secondary containment, which is actually the thing that you've put these particular storage things in. Right. And so when you're talking about burying things, then you will have some kind of containment protocol in that area as well. Mm. And I think it even gets up to tertiary containment in some designs and so on. But yes, so they can and will probably corrode at some point, and then you will be looking at a secondary means of containing that. right? And but that is designed, and that is something that people do think about when they design these very, very long-term, tens of thousands of years storage facilities.
But they've, again, no answers yet on long-term disposal or how you deal with this thing.
Well, I mean, the long-term quote-unquote disposal, the fundamental problem with this kind of radioactivity is it's there for a long time. Right?
Yeah.
And so if you're going to put it away, you've got to put it away somewhere for tens of thousands of years. And then you want to find somewhere that's geologically stable for that period. And that's kind of not a trivial thing to do because we don't really have that longer amount or that long an amount of information about the relative geoactivity of given areas. So it's kind of difficult, but nonetheless, geologists will tell you where they think things are pretty stable.
I mean, there have been talk, and this is a number of years back, I read about hollowing out some of the Canadian Shield, some of the rocket.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Is that feasible at all?
It's all, you can do that, but it's very expensive,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that is the thing. If you wind up with a situation where it's so expensive to get rid of the waste, why are you doing it?
Yeah. There was a story in the news on the weekend. I think it's the Bruce nuclear plant in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
There's First Nations right nearby, mm-hmm. and there had been some kind of arrangement to dispose the nuclear waste in that area, but the First Nations is now objecting, and so that's kind of throwing a question mark into the whole expansion of the Bruce, I think it's the Bruce Pickering nuclear plant in Ontario. Rick's on the line. He's got a question for us. Good morning, Rick.
Hello.
Hello, sir. You're on with Dr. Rob. You have a question.
It's more of a comment on the cows in space.
Okay.
Okay.
Wouldn't it make more sense to take fertilized embryos wherever they were going and then just grow them when they get there?
Well, I suppose
that's
a possibility
idea.
As well.
Not a bad idea at all.
It takes care of the, you know, the...
But you still got to feed them on the other end.
You do indeed. And you still got to deal with the output problem as well. 10:52 is the time here right now. Let's talk about black holes caught in the act of swallowing stars. Tell me more about this.
Yeah, so this
is... Isn't that what black holes do, by the way?
Nom. So this is actually... We get to see now an entire star stretched apart by a black hole and then pulled into the black hole.
Right? Oh, really? Okay.
And so when this happens, it's a pretty violent process. And so you imagine stars even bigger than the sun being torn apart by the black hole, going down and then sort of rotating around and forming a disk of material that eventually falls into the black hole. And as it forms that disk, which we call an accretion disk, there can be a release of lots and lots of energy and creates this big flash. And so these tidal disruption events, as they're called, are a really interesting way of understanding how many black holes are out there, but also the properties and masses of the black holes that are out there as well. So how do you find them? There are certain class of flash that you see in the sky. You then go and follow them up with a telescope. You take spectra of them so you can see what elements are emitting what kind of light and so on. And then you follow this over time to see how it dies down. And so we only had a few of these, but now there is a whole telescope that's devoted, the Zwicky Transient Factory, to finding sort of like these transitory events happening on the sky. And this is really big news because this is literally astronomy moving into an era where we've gone from saying, those galaxies, they take billions of years to evolve, won't see anything there, to starting to say, well, what happens when we look at the universe on the scale of a few days? What do we see? Right. So this is now part of that way of thinking about, let's look at the things that are changing on a few days and hours timescales. And so that's a really new thing. The Zwicky Transient Factory is one of the first things to do that. That's off in California. But the next generation Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, or the Vera Rubin Telescope, we talked about this the other week, that is going to be taking a whole image of the entire southern sky every 3 days.
Really?
Right. So you'll be able, and certain parts of it on different cadences as well. So you'll have more and more data on different timescales as well. And so that will bring about a revolution in what we call transient astronomy.
Transient astronomy.
Yeah.
10:55 is the time right now. Wrapping things up here, let's talk about the ongoing scare with the coronavirus and all the misinformation that is. At one time they linked it to snakes, and then it was to another food group. And I really don't think that they're 100% sure just, where the origin of this. Again, a lot of misinformation being spread out there.
Well, the worst case is a number or a lot of this misinformation is seeded basically with, in some cases, racist viewpoints on the Chinese and so on. So there was a number of things that were circulating online and people making really inappropriate comments in one way or another. But this is the concern that I have, that if you look at the SARS outbreak, SARS was 2003, right? And we really didn't have big social media at that point, if I remember correctly. Social media really kind of gets going around 2007, 2008, 2009. There's probably Facebook might have been just about growing at that time, I would guess. So we didn't have that sort of like place to go for quote unquote information. Whereas now people get their news from social.
Yeah.
Right. And that is a huge issue. So the BBC did this study on all of these things that were coming out. And basically there was a lot of really silly things about, look, you might be at danger of this if you're walking around in your day to day. And it's like, no, seriously, at the moment, this is really quite well contained. In terms of the actual fatality rate, that's one thing that we don't know particularly well. The estimates suggest it could be around 2%. If it's around 2%, it's not as bad as SARS. SARS was estimated to be up around 10%. But we don't honestly know. There could be many, many, many more people infected in Wuhan than we know about.
Yeah, that's the thought.
And then the actual mortality rate is going to be less.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a lot of unknown things. And so really be super careful when you're looking on social media and someone's sharing something. There was even this conspiracy theory that had been released because some institute somewhere wanted money to develop a vaccine. And I can assure you, I know lots of people who work in medical research, this kind of situation is a nightmare for them. They absolutely don't want to be in a position where they're suddenly getting money to develop a vaccine because people are dying. They don't want to be put in a situation like that. So the good news is that there are things that people can try. The antiviral drugs for other viruses are going to be the first things that people try. We should be hearing something about that fairly soon, I would think, because I'm sure they're testing them. And then the vaccine, we'll see how things go. I mean, is it cost effective to go out and develop that vaccine? There's going to be a lot of money. It will take a long time. If antivirals work, will they go with that? And so on. There's going to be a lot of questions about this, but watch where you get your information from.
Yep.
Go to a news source that you actually trust.
Yeah,
okay?
But the thing with this coronavirus is it's rapid spread, but if there's a silver lining, it's in 1% to 2% death rate. And compared to
1% to 2% death rate is bad. I mean, let's look at flu. Flu kills, 400,000 people a year around the globe, right? Yeah. And the death rate for that is below 1%, right?
Oh, really? Okay.
Well below 1%. Yeah.
You know, compared it to SARS, though.
SARS was much more lethal. Yep. So.
But health officials around the world are now trying to grapple with this. The World Health Organization has declared a global health emergency to help that deal with that situation. So, again, we just have to deal with facts.
Get your information from somewhere like the CDC or World Health Organization or somewhere like that.
I'm going to mention coming up in the next hour, there's a restaurant, a Chinese restaurant in Sydney that has told Chinese students at the University of Cape Breton, you're not welcome in our restaurant anymore. So there's this ridiculous, you know, reaction that's going on out there
no,
right
that's
now.
So inappropriate. I mean, I don't know what to say.
Yeah. I hear you there. Dr. Rob, another hour flies by. Thank you very much.
Cows in space. Amazing week. There we go.
Indeed. See you next Monday. Thank you very much. Dr. Rob joins us every Monday at this time for Science Files, our weekly look at news from the world of science. 2 minutes now before 11 o'clock, we're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We're going to the phones for our first open hour of the week. We call it Manic Monday, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Give me a call. Anything goes next hour, and we'll take your calls after the news, and it is coming up next.